Burned by this leftover from last time, I guess, in a sense you could say, is the notion of faith. Faith, as I tried, I've had some ideas, I'd like to pull a few of them together. What faith has to be for us is believing in Jesus. That means committing all of that we are to the person of Jesus. And please, watch this. Believing in is very different from learning about. Very, very different. Most of us believe that faith deals with learning about Jesus. It would be comparable to going down to the library, if I gave you a name of someone you never heard of, who was famous, going through the encyclopedias and learning a lot of facts about this person. That's what most of us think that faith is. For years we've heard many facts about Jesus. That he's pre-existent, that he was born in Bethlehem, that roughly around the age of 30 he began a public ministry. We know many of the things that he said, many of the incidents that happened during this public ministry, incidents of people that he healed and how he healed them. We know that he was opposed by the Pharisees and the scribes. We know that he died. We know that he rose. And this is what we think faith is. The fact that we are willing to accept what we know about Jesus, what we have learned about Jesus, is true. And that is not what faith is at all. The other great, you know, it's this big thing, like the example I've used once with the chair. You can learn many things about this chair. You can believe that this chair will hold your weight. But unless you believe in the chair to the degree to commit your weight to it, it does you no good. What you know about the chair won't help. What you believe about the chair won't give you rest if you're exhausted. Committing yourself to the chair, believing in the chair, does. Please, don't let what I'm sharing with you become an encyclopedia of new things you will know about Jesus. There's only one challenge. You don't have to know almost anything, and you can believe in Jesus and experience what it is to be saved. You can know many, many things and not experience Jesus and live hungry. We hear creeds, and we have an ancient one that we read every Sunday, so we think that faith deals with a lot of things that are to believe, especially since we say we believe in God. We believe in the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, we believe in one baptism, etc. But there's only one choice that a Christian is confronted with, to believe in Jesus. There's really one choice I believe everybody who has ever hears of Jesus is confronted with, to believe in Jesus or not to. And to believe in anything else is not to believe in Jesus. To turn to anything else for the solution of any problem is not to believe in Jesus. If we're turning to it in preference to turning to Jesus. You see, believing in Jesus is believing in that those three words, and we'll get more of these. It's that the Lord, and that's believing that he's God, so that he can do it, became Jesus so that he becomes one with us. The Lord became Jesus. He who exists eternally took on our flesh. He knows what it's like to be me. Now, if I just said man, that has no meaning. He knows what it's like to be you as an individual. That's what Jesus is. That's the astounding part of that. So that he could be our Christ. So that he could save. And if I'm turning to something else, then I'm not believing that Jesus is my Christ. There is one Lord. Insurance policies are not the Lords of my life. Bank accounts aren't the Lords of my life. I've used them. Money isn't the Lord of my life. I've used it. Material goods aren't the Lord of my life. I used them. I still do. I keep going back to them. You know, just because I don't believe in Jesus doesn't mean that the whole universe ends for me. My day is a constant struggle between believing in Jesus and believing in other things. I just go back and forth. When I believe in Jesus, I experience peace. It's all great. But I just keep going back and back and forth. I use this example. I don't know if I shared it with you. If I did, there are certain things that are important enough. It would be similar to, I think I did, where if I put $1 billion in the bank in your name, right now, if I went down, you know, told you, hey, I've put $1 billion in the bank in your name. If you don't believe, oh, I got a reason for sharing this. Wait. There's two words. I'm going to give you my impression of these words now. We're dealing with faith first. We are all redeemed. We are not all saved. All mankind is redeemed. Very few of us are saved. Now, what I mean by this is, Jesus has put that $1 billion in the bank for every single person on this earth. Many of us have never heard of Jesus, so we don't know how wealthy we are. Many others don't believe in it. Some may believe that Jesus has given them this, but they don't believe enough to write a check on it. And so they're trying to go through life on what they can earn inside. And it isn't doing them any good. Some believe enough in Jesus to write the checks again and again and again and again. What I mean by writing the checks is that really believing that I have every spiritual blessing in the heavens within me, that I'm attaining to the fullness of God, and that therefore there is beauty in me regardless of what I think of myself and regardless of what you think of me. I have someone to offer you. I have infinite value to offer you. I have agios, or holiness, that which comes from God alone to offer you. Man can't produce it. And it's in me so that I can share it with you. And you have it too. All of us are redeemed. Most of us are asleep. Being saved is, as I understand the word, the degree of your waking up to what Jesus is doing for you. And we can constantly forget it. In other words, what I mean by being saved is I'm really allowing Jesus to save me. I don't have to be good, because I'm perfect. With the perfection of the Spirit of Jesus, and I celebrate that. That's letting Jesus. Now, I'm not going to get into what they call quietism, where I don't do anything. But I can't do anything as far as being redeemed. Jesus has done it. His blood is everything. I'm saved. I'm perfect. I have the Spirit of Jesus alive in me. It transforms me. It changes me. It's exciting. Now, I either believe that or I don't. My not believing, my not having faith in Jesus doesn't take it away. Jesus will not unredeem me. I'm redeemed. All mankind is. All sin has been nailed to the cross. But does it do us any good if we don't know it? If you're a billionaire and think you're poor, does it do you any good? No. You're rich and unsaved. You're rich and dying. You're rich and starving to death. We're all rich, but we've got to believe in Jesus to know it. It's the only way I know that I'm saved. That's what being saved is, believing in Jesus. Believing that He does it. Believing that He is the answer. And there's no pill that you take. That's why I'm happy I shared with you how I go through a day. Most of the time I'm believing in other things. I have a tendency when things get bad to run out and buy some stereo equipment. That's my big compulsion. When I'm really feeling depressed, I want to go into a stereo store. I went down on the 5th to Crossroads, the 4th to Crossroads with a friend of mine. Had a great day shopping Crossroads, and God took care of me. There were 9 out of 10 stores, at least, in Crossroads. It's in Oklahoma City. It's 120-some stores. 9 out of 10 stores were open. The stores where I would have spent my money were closed, including the only quality stereo component store in the mall. So God didn't want me to buy anything, and I was feeling depressed, and I could have. That becomes the answer. How am I going to handle my depression? I'll turn to a thing, which means I'm believing in a thing as the answer to depression. Well, it isn't. I'm not saved then. There's emptiness. No stereo equipment that I've ever bought has saved me. It's distracted me from my emptiness for a while, but it's never saved me. All I got to do is just believe that in Jesus, even if I feel depressed, I am it. I have every spiritual blessing in the heavens. I'm part of the body of Christ. The Father is in love with me. I'm the beloved of God. The Father's madly in love with me. He's kookily in love with me. It just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make any sense at all. If you think about it, I shared this with my Matthew class. God just, he just spoils everybody. You sin, and how does God answer sin? He doubly rewards us. We shared this last time. What did Adam do? He sinned. How did God answer? He sent Jesus to become one with us, to give us his own spirit. Man lost one level of friendship, and in telling God, no, I don't want this limited amount of love, he got a whole new creation to live, a whole higher one. That's how God loves. If I believe in this, that's going to handle depression. I can think I have no value. I can go back to early programming and figure people don't like me. I can believe that if Jesus is saving me, I have his spirit, and therefore I have a mission. Whether I see it, whether I feel it, whether the world sees it, Jesus is saying, I've got it. And that's being saved. Nothing automatic. Faith isn't a pill you take once. I cannot agree, nor does anybody that I know who reads Scripture correctly, in the idea of those people who say, once you are saved, you're always saved. Paul certainly doesn't hold that. Otherwise, he'd never be warning the Christians again and again and again. We are always redeemed. We've been redeemed by the blood of the cross. We can never lose that. But the number of times when I've lost God's peace because I get distracted by anything else proved to me that once saved, not always saved, and the New Testament certainly shows the same thing. What am I going to believe in? And will I believe in Jesus? That's what being saved is. Will I believe right at this moment that I'm rich? With every spiritual blessing in the heavens, then I'm saved. If I don't, then I'm not saved. So, just giving you, incidentally, you can't prove it. This is a confusion that a lot of people want. For example, people come to the first class, and what they really want me to do is to prove that God exists. If I could prove to you today that God exists, you could not believe in God. By anybody's definition of the word belief, you would have a knowledge of God, and what you know, you can't believe. What you cannot know, you're able to believe. If you got enough witnesses, you'd probably take them both on faith. I've shared this, and it's the best example. You can know your mother. You can prove who your mother is. You can only have faith in who your father is. You cannot prove that. You can get the nurses who were in the delivery room to testify this woman is your mother. With that knowledge, it's impossible from that point on to believe that she's my mother. I know it. But no one can ever prove who my father is. I've got to take my mother's word. And that's faith. And that's the big difference. A lot of people look for knowledge, and this isn't how God has done it. Faith, pretty much, I'll give you three words, in a sense. Faith deals with the past. Love deals with the present. And hope deals with the future. Now, hope is a terrible word, and we've got to change it. Because The virtue of hope has nothing to do with what the English word has come to mean.
It does not mean I wish that. It means I have total confidence that. There isn't a shadow of doubt in Christian hope.
Because Jesus has emptied himself of all that he is on the cross for me, I believe,
I go back to the past, to all of his past action, all that he's done,
that at this moment he is standing in my midst and he's giving me all, everything that God has.
He's loving me. And I love to be loved, so I respond to his goodness with love.
Looking on his record of the past and believing that that record will continue into the future because he is unchanging, that he will never fail me, I can relax in his presence and enjoy what he is doing for me at this moment, and that's love.
Faith very much deals with the past, basically, not with the future. Hope deals with the next moment. Love deals with this moment.
Schmaltzy, but every so often schmaltzy things are nice.
The cross will remind you, can remind you of faith, hope, and charity.
The cross is firmly embedded in the earth, and that's what faith is. The cross is open to the heavens, and that's hope. Past, future, no end to this, firmly founded in what has actually happened.
The cross being the cross is open to the world, and that's love.
And, you know, we should be right here where they intersect, nailing ourselves down to all three.
Another very beautiful image of the cross is it combines our two loves.
The horizontal one, God's love coming into our life, and the vertical one,
just got horizontal and vertical mixed up, didn't I?
The vertical one, God coming down into our lives, the horizontal one, our with love, and our responding to that love, the horizontal one going out in love.
But anyhow, faith, hope, and love.
So the virtue of hope, faith, is just taking all that we are and just giving it right to Jesus, to a person, not to a thought. No thought has ever saved me. And it's just a gamble. You just got to really believe. You know, you're not going to feel any different. You want to believe in Jesus, and you're going to believe that Jesus has done it all and that you're excellent. You start believing that, and you have a doubt. You know, when you do this, you're not going to feel different. No great Shazam's going to happen, and you're going to start levitating, floating up to the ceiling. Uh-uh. You're going to feel the same person. You'll have stomach cramps if you had diarrhea before you try to do it. The diarrhea might still be with you. You're going to feel physically the same person, emotionally the same person. Spiritually, on a very deep level, new things will happen. And I ought to get to those words. Because I prefer the Bible words. There's two sets of words. Body and soul. And they're both in the New Testament.
That comes out of Greek,
as the Greeks have them.
The body is what you touch, the soul is what you don't. Okay? The soul's immortal, we all have a soul.
That we pretty well all know.
It is not the Hebrew thought, and it isn't what Paul talks about, and I deeply prefer what Paul talks about.
Paul will use the word body because he's writing in Greek, but he would probably prefer the word, the Greek, a Hebrew or an Aramaic would use the word flesh. Body, and then he'll use the word soul, and then he'll use the word spirit. And it's a completely different way of thinking. You cannot carry this thought over to this thought.
You get very confused.
Body refers to your body,
the real you.
Well, let's start the other way. Soul is every sensation you have. Okay, so it would be your thoughts, your emotions, your ideas, your feelings, your drives. If you ever had a chance to study enough philosophy, for the Greeks, part of your feelings are in your body.
Your feelings are, your thoughts are in your soul. Just a thought. But like if I touch you, that's a physical sensation. So for a Greek, that's felt in the body, not in the soul. Not for a Hebrew. Any sensation, anything you experience, so the whole you of your consciousness, that's the soul. But the Hebrews cannot picture a soul existing by itself. So the soul is enfleshed. We are living bodies. Therefore, the body is what your soul is enfleshed in. Now, you got this third level, the spirit. That's the deepest part of you where God touches you. And I didn't really know anything about this till in a small way I started experiencing it. My body can be down, I can be tired, and I can be a little bit depressed. And yet deep in the deepest level of my being, I can have a small experience of God still touching me. That occurs in the spirit. Directly where God touches us. Now this is how Paul talks. And I can't, all I can do is say I've experienced all three. And then to give a deeper definition, I can't. But just, there are, and this would be the whole Old Testament way of doing it. If they're translating them correctly. And you can't take the Greek thought that many of us have heard, body and soul, and read them into the Old Testament, nor into all parts of the New Testament. Just by way of saying this, like as an example, we know that we have certain parts of the Last Supper that haven't been reported correctly. When Jesus takes the bread and says, "This is my body," he couldn't have said it. There is no Aramaic word for body. And that's the language he spoke. There is just the word flesh. But when Matthew, Mark, and Luke and Paul translated, they thought it would be too horrible to say, "This is my flesh." It sounded too much like cannibalism. So when they put it into Greek, they put it not into the Greek word for flesh, they put it into the nicer Greek word for body. And that's how it came down to us. But John, in his gospel, has a very good echo of this. In the bread of life discourse, when Jesus says, "Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood," that's Aramaic. Jesus is talking in Hebrew. There is no word for body, so he couldn't have said it for the human body. There's just the word for flesh in the Aramaic, which Jesus spoke in the Hebrew. So you got this double distinction of where they, the terms, just to kind of give you some background. I can feel guilt. Now to go back, because what I'm doing basically is still accenting faith, since it's what we're called to do. I can feel guilt because I failed someone. I haven't lived as perfectly as I feel I should. I really goofed, and I'm down on myself. Then I can believe in Jesus, and I can believe that God is at peace with me. And on God's being at peace with me, I then can accept myself. That's having faith in Jesus. I can be filled with fear. I can believe in Jesus. Now, fear generally is there isn't enough power in me to face some situation. Fear generally flows from something coming on right now or in the future. And that's, if you would take that distinction I made between faith, love, and hope, that would be more the area of the virtue of hope. I can, but it's hope is based on faith, and so is love. If I don't have faith in Jesus, I'm not going to love him. If I don't have faith in Jesus, there won't be any virtue of hope. Faith, hope is simply taking the faith of yesterday and carrying it over till tomorrow. And I can believe that Jesus will never allow anything to happen to me that will ever affect my peace. That's all that he guarantees. That his spirit is mine, and there isn't a force in the universe that will take that spirit from me if I want him to continue loving me. And that can enable me to relax and to wash away much of the fear. So
When we talk about Abraham, the great example of faith, let's not confuse faith. Abraham didn't believe a catechism. He didn't know a lot of things about Yahweh. He didn't even know, from as far as we can tell, that there was only one God. He thought he was listening to the chief God, not the only God. But he believed in him. He put his whole life in his hands, and he followed where he led. When we commit our whole life to Jesus, we're going to have touches of love. And Jesus then will follow us, and will guide us slowly. His love will call us where we ought to be going. Since we're dealing with, there's just a few more moments before this tape will end, we're dealing with background thought, I'll just share this with you. I was going to do it just a little bit more into it. About 100 to 150 years ago, a group of German scholars who did not believe in God set out to tear the Bible to shreds and to prove that the Bible was false. They were scholarly, so they started to study the Bible scientifically. And for quite a while, what they did turned the world of religion upside down and gave people strokes, religious people. Up until their time, everybody believed, just about everybody, believed that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, all written by Moses. Believed that David wrote the Psalms. Believed that Solomon wrote the wisdom literature. And they just, from their investigation, said, that's all nonsense. It can't be. Most of the Pentateuch is written long after Moses is dead, up to 1,000 years after the death of Moses, which really would be the greatest feat of penmanship in the world history. The Psalms, David lives about the year 1000. He's real simple to date, 1000 before Jesus. And the Psalms are written as late as some of them as 300 years before Jesus, 700 years after he dies. And the same thing for the wisdom literature. It's written, a lot of it, 700 years after Solomon dies. So David didn't write the Psalms, Solomon didn't write the wisdom books, and Moses didn't write the Pentateuch. And the priests over in Rome were having a stroke when they heard those three. You know, for 1,500 years, 1,800 years, we've been teaching that Moses wrote this, that David wrote that, and that Solomon wrote this, and now you're throwing it out. These scholars are terrible. They have made the greatest contributions to Bible scholarship possible today. They would have given them a stroke if they knew that, because, as I said, these were people mainly who did not believe in God and who began to rip the Bible. Their purpose was to rip the Bible to shreds and show that there is no history at all behind the Bibles. But there are scholars. And scholars just can't break away from what they want. So, first thing you got to do is get the right text. If you're going to prove that the Bible's a lot of slop, you got to get the Bible. Get what? What was the first five books? So, they began scholarly study that is producing some of the most accurate text. Remember, we talked on that one on the Bible, the difficulties there. The next thing, if you're going to tear it to shreds, is you need good translations. Don't settle, now I'll update this, don't settle for the King James Version if you're going to attack the Bible, because you might be attacking the wrong phrase. You might be attacking something the Bible doesn't say. So let's put it into good German. Let's put it in from there into good French, into good English. Two great benefits that we're benefiting from today. Coupled with this, God has blessed us with discovering more about the area and the time that produced the Bible than any other generation probably before printing was invented. The area is very dry, and they have discovered, since all this stuff began, entire libraries, not a book, but entire libraries of the other Semites. They would be kiss and kin to the Hebrews.
that they're the same stock, like they'd have the same ancestors, okay? Whole libraries that help us discover exactly the literary forms that use the Bible. That's how we know so much about these literary forms. They've discovered entire libraries, and they have been stumbling, fortunately, ever since the Rosetta Stone had the same thing in three different languages, one of which we knew, enable people to break hieroglyphics. They've been breaking these languages left and right. They can read these libraries, and they know what's happened. They know how people formed a covenant at the time of Abraham. And they know the way Abraham did it was right. Because there's evidences of this in these libraries. They know how people formed a covenant at the time of Moses. And that's how God covenants with his people. That's the pattern used. So, because of a lucky, well, not a lucky break, God has seen fit to give us an unbelievable amount of evidence for the time when these events occurred and for the times when the Bible was produced. Beginning with these German scholars then, we have come to a scientific discovery and look at the Bible. What has happened is that what originally turned out to turn the Bible upside down and show there was no history has revealed how much history there is at certain times. There's going to be one story that we'll get to in a moment. Well, we have got to it. Joseph. Joseph goes down into Egypt, and he and all of Jacob's, all of Israel, comes down to Egypt, and they get good jobs. That just doesn't make sense. And after so many years, the Bible says 400, they're all enslaved. These people who were treated well for 400 years, all of a sudden, they're hated. Now that just doesn't make sense to anybody. For example, we wouldn't take a group of Vietnamese in America right now and